Good morning. It's nice to see so many familiar faces in the audience. But for those of you that don't know us, my name is Dawn Grossman. I'm an associate director in our member oversight department. And as Matt mentioned, this is Tara and John. They're going to be speaking with me on our first panel, which is how to prepare for an NFA exam and common findings on NFA exams. Just a little bit about myself. I've spent my career at NFA. I have worked in both exams as well as our financial analysis and surveillance team. Currently, I am overseeing a few different teams that focus exam teams that focus on CPOs, CTAs, and IBs. Started with the exam. And also, as Matt mentioned, please feel free to ask questions at any point in time. But we just ask that you wait for to get the microphone before you ask your question, just so that everyone in the audience can hear. And as Matt mentioned, it is being recorded. So the exam process. How many of you have gone through the exam process in the past?
Okay, that's quite a bit of you. Partly, I guess, that we feel like that the exam itself could maybe be a little intimidating if you have not gone through it before. Knowing what the process looks like and any common findings that we typically see, we're hoping that this panel will help make it a little less anxious for you when your time does come.
Okay.
We have a risk-based approach to our exams. This applies to both the firms that are selected for exams as well as the scope that we choose for our exams. So just to give you an idea of how a firm is selected for the exams, we have a risk analysis group, and this group works with models. The models take information from your member questionnaire that you submit, your financial statements, disclosure documents, maybe customer complaints that have been submitted to us. And it will produce a list of firms that they think that should be examined in the upcoming quarter. We then have a group of people that do a qualitative analysis. They are going to look at the results that have been spit out. They're going to analyze the data, consider the risks. Maybe there's certain areas we're going to focus on in the next quarter, and we want to look at that, or there's certain locations. And they're going to produce the final list of firms for the upcoming quarter that we're going to examine. Then, once we have the firms that we are selecting, we're going to also take a risk-based approach to the scopes that we're going to do. So, no two exams is going to be exactly alike. We're going to again take the information that you've submitted in your member questionnaire or your financial statements, your disclosure documents. We're going to also ask you some preliminary questions, and this is going to help us narrow in on the areas that we're going to look at for your specific firm. So, John, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And then can you introduce the audiences to what we're going to do to start an exam and the approach we're going to take?
Great. Thanks, Dawn. My name is John Dempsey. I've been with NFA for 9 years. I'm a manager the past 4 or 5 years with a focus in FCM and FDM examinations. It's great that so many of you have been through an exam because this slide will be really easy for me. So, announcing an exam, we typically announce an exam 2 to 4 weeks in advance. We will send along a pre-exam questionnaire. Can you turn your mic off? We'll send along a pre-exam questionnaire, which will have some basic information we're requesting about the firm's operations, personnel, along with an internal controls questionnaire, which will be the firm's representation on certain financial functions and processes. We'll follow that up with an operations call in which we'll go over the firm's operations, review any questions we might have regarding the pre-exam questionnaire or the internal controls questionnaire, discuss logistics such as field work, timing of the exam, any specifics that we need to get into. One important caveat to the announcement timeline: while the majority of our registration categories are announced in advance, FCM and FDM exams are technically unannounced exams. We announce those the day of to do certain testing of current books and records. While we previously would show up at the firm's premises, we would show up at your firm the day of the announcement. We've begun a process where we will call from our offices, begin some virtual field work for a couple of weeks to give the firm time to produce documents to us before going on site. We still reserve the right to go on site the day of if we need to, but something to keep in mind that those are technically unannounced exams. And in terms of documentation delivery, we use a system called the Regulatory Filing System. You'll hear it referred to as RFS. It's a secure portal where the firm will upload its documents and we will upload our document request list for tracking. In terms of due dates, we typically ask the firm to try to stick to a 2 to 3 day turnaround time. That's not a hard and fast rule. We are flexible. If there are documents that are hard to get, you have to go through different departments. Maybe it's a bespoke or unique request that is going to require someone to build it. Let the exam team know. We always try to be flexible with that. At NFA, our default mode of communication is through Teams. If we're setting up a meeting, it'll come across as a Microsoft Teams meeting. We do have access to other forms of communication, such as Google or Zoom. We can't create meetings with those, but so if that's something that the firm would prefer as their method of communication, then we would just default to you to schedule meetings, and that's not a problem. In terms of on-site field work, we typically spend anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks, depending on the scope of the examination. For a first-time examination, it might be longer, shorter for a firm that we've been to maybe a few times. We would spend that time interviewing key personnel. We'll let you know in advance what personnel we would want available, but this could include anyone from the AML officer to people in the cyber department. I mentioned the internal control questionnaire where you'll detail certain aspects of your financial functions. We also spend this time performing walkthroughs of those financial functions to review the firm's controls and the personnel maintaining these processes. We'll review firm records. Again, we use RFS for our primary mode of delivery, but if there are certain documents that the firm feels are sensitive, we can, of course, view those while on site, payroll records, legal records. Just let us know what documents you have concerns over sharing, and we'll figure something out. If it occurs after field work, that's something that maybe we can do over Teams. And we'll always be sure to discuss findings with you. If we identify something, or even if it's something that we're looking into, we'll let you know that we have concerns over it. And if we identify a deficiency, then we will let you know and give you ample time to provide us with corrective action. Some logistics about on-site fieldwork: we will typically arrive with anywhere from 5 to 7 people. So if that's a problem, let us know in terms of space. Could be larger. For example, an FDM examination, we might come on site with people from our Fortress department. For any of our exams, we might come on site with people from our Promo or Cyber department. We'll let you know in advance, but just keep in mind that we'll need a dedicated working space. And as mentioned before, Teams screen sharing, email, RFS, phone calls, whatever the firm's primary or preferred method of communication is, just let us know and we'll work with that.
Thanks, John. Tara, can you introduce yourself? And now that we've gone through how the exam starts and the approach to the exam, can you tell us how it wraps up?
Yes, thanks, John. Can everyone hear me? Hi, I'm Tara Rabal. I'm a manager in the Member Oversight Department. I have been with the NFA since 2015, and I specialize in exams of our CPO, CTA, and IB members. I'm super excited to be here with you today. And please come up after as well to ask any questions you may have. So I'm going to focus on my slide, the end of exam process. So this is everyone's favorite day, the exit interview. So at the end of the exam, we will have a formal meeting with you to summarize all of our findings that we had during the exam. Like John said, we'll let you know during the exam process, you know, we'll keep you abreast if there are any findings throughout, but we set up this formal meeting at the end of the exam to summarize our findings to you. This is also the time to discuss any corrective action that you've taken or you will take in the future. And then after the exit interview, we will send you issue an exam report. The exam report will have, you know, a due date on when you should respond by. Typically, it's like 10 business days, but again, we're super flexible. If you need more time to respond to that, we're happy to work with you. In the firm's response, it will need to be a formal response to the letter, and you will have to respond with what circumstances led to the finding. And again, any corrective action that you have implemented or changes to your internal controls. Okay, tips for an efficient exam. So in order for things to run smoothly for us, it's very important that, you know, the firm personnel are available, you know, when we do come on site. Like our first, the 2 weeks that we're on site that John had mentioned is really, we try to get as much testing done in that 2 week timeframe. And just the availability of the firm personnel is very, very helpful to our process. We will have questions and requests throughout the exam process. We will send you document request lists in RFS, like John mentioned. And then, you know, just frequent touch points, transparency. If you don't understand what we're looking for, please give us a call. We're happy to talk you through it. Yeah, so the more frequent touch points and communication we can have with you, it just helps for a smoother exam process. And post-fieldwork engagement. So like I said, at the beginning of the exam, when it's just starting up, it's a lot of time we're on site in the field talking to you guys and people at the firm. However, throughout the whole exam cycle, it's very, very important to remain as responsive as ever. I tell firms this all the time, you know, what document production is really important to us. The faster you can get things to us, the faster our teams and our examiners can work on those items and hopefully be for a more efficient exam process.
Thank you, Tara. Before we move on, does anyone have any questions on the exam process?
Where was the question?
Okay.
Yeah, hi. Just quickly, on the conclusion of the exam, you said there's an exam report and then you have a period of time to respond. What happens next and how does a firm know when everything is concluded?
So after, you know, the response is given to us, that's typically the end of the exam process. You know, a manager will reach out and confirm receipt of the response, and that kind of ends it there.
If the response isn't adequate, we would follow up with additional questions or tell you some additional items we would need. Then you would know it was continuing.
Okay. And if there's additional questions and you respond to those, what then?
If you had additional questions, you're saying, or once you respond to the additional questions, most of the time, if we've gone back, we need a little bit more of a response, more adequate response. Usually it's done after that point. If not, you will know because we will still be in communications with you.
Yeah. And if you're unsure, you can always ask as well.
Okay. Thank you.
It's not uncommon for some exams, especially for some exams, to require multiple responses. And if there was anything in the exam that we were keeping open as a follow-up review, we would let you know that in advance of closing the exam.
Any other questions?
I know that this is really firm subjective, but the length of the exam, I mean, I've been in situations like it's 6 weeks to 12 months and chat on that, why some things last so much longer than others maybe, and when we can expect to get the notice of our final meeting.
We can pretty much guarantee 6 weeks probably will not happen. We are required to send out a report within 150 days from the start of field work. So when we reach out to you, that's not necessarily the start of field work. That's some of our pre-exam work. And then
is field work also just digital things? We don't have a physical office. So like field work, we would never have someone come to us. So when you say, do you mean like when we had our first kickoff call?
The first kickoff call is usually still a little preliminary.
Okay.
But once we've received documents and then have a follow-up meeting with that, that's usually your indication that field work has begun.
Okay, sure. Sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to ask about like the official start point. Can you finish the rest of that answer?
Yeah. Again, it's 150 days, but it's not like we're doing multiple exams at the same time. So we're not just focused on you during that entire time. It's a lot in the beginning, especially when we're in field work. The document requests typically get much less as time goes on. And then, like Tara had said before, we'll have an exit interview at the end, and you'll know that we're coming to the conclusion of the exam.
We have one more question here.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned before about the frequency being risk-based, but my understanding is that there is like minimum or max times also between exams, at least for the FCM community. So if you could talk about that for a second. And then I understand that shot clock we were just talking about, I think it starts the day of the engagement letter. Is that right?
Yeah, so for the first part of your question, for FCM exams specifically, there's a CFTC rule where we start those typically anywhere between 9 and 15 months. So they're somewhat regular. For the start of the exam for an FCM, yes, it would be the day that we send you the engagement letter. For other registration categories, you may get that initial engagement letter prior to the start of the exam, and generally the first day is when we are on site. For an FCM, it would be when we send you the engagement letter and we conduct our first day, like current day books and records.
So for a low risk exam based on your analysis and it goes 15 months, that 15 month period is based on the as of date, right?
We select a date for financial testing, so it might be as of March 31st, and generally 9 on the low end, but generally like 12 to 14 months, 15 would be on the long end.
So if you started an exam today, you would be testing, say, April 30th, right?
Yes.
And then that's like, if it's 15 months, then it would be next July.
Yeah, so 15, we would be testing, we would have to test 15 months from April 30th, so it would be. Sometime after that.
Any other questions?
Okay. So moving on to common exam findings. Many of our exams have very similar findings. If you understand these common findings, it's going to help you strengthen your compliance programs and just help you avoid these findings in the future. So these first findings we're going to discuss, these apply to all registration categories. So one of the most common things is procedures. We're going to look at various procedures. It could be your cybersecurity, your AML, promotion material, third-party service providers, internal controls, et cetera. One of the most common findings that we find with your procedures is not having any procedures at all, or not having adequate procedures. My biggest tip for this really is to spend the time going through the self-examination questionnaire. This is on our website. All members are required to do this every year. And it is very, if you really spend the time to go through it, it's very detailed. It highlights the procedures you need to have in place. It links you to rules and interpretive notices. It even has several appendices to kind of help you tailor your procedures. And then you just want to make sure once you have these procedures that you feel like your procedures are addressing the risks of your firm. So now that you've got good procedures in place, the next common finding we have is firms not following their procedures. So again, just make sure that you've got your procedures and you're actually following the procedures that you have in place. And then the last thing would be is to make sure that you have evidence that you're following your procedures, whether you're initialing a document or you're creating a log and signing and dating it on when you've completed your reviews. These are all things that we're going to look for when we come in to do an exam. John, do you want to go through some other common findings?
Yeah, so third-party service providers, it's a few years old, but still relatively one of our newer interpretive notices. It's 9079, and this governs not all third-party relationships, but those that cover any regulatory obligations. And some key things to remember as part of that interpretive notice is that the firm must conduct an initial risk assessment over the third party. And what regulatory obligations will they be covering? How do they handle data? How do they respond to service disruptions? That goes hand in hand with the onboarding due diligence, which will also include a written agreement governing the services that the third party will be providing to your firm. Ongoing monitoring should be conducting an annual review of any third parties that are performing regulatory obligations. Have they been in the news? Has their credit change of any of their key personnel or services change? In terms of termination, this is a specific thing that we look for in the third party agreement. The firm must retain the right to be able to exit that relationship, especially in the event of any adverse circumstances that might impact that third party. And as Dawn mentioned, just maintaining documentation of all of these processes, the initial risk assessment, the onboarding due diligence, the ongoing monitoring. A couple other things to keep in mind is that this does specifically call out affiliates. That's an area where we've had some firms that maybe the due diligence over an affiliate wasn't there because it's a sister or parent entity. The member firm is still required to adhere to these requirements for affiliates as well. Some other common categories, associated persons, APs. This is for anyone who solicits for funds, customers, orders, they are required to be registered as an AP. Not just the person directly doing the solicitation, but anybody who supervises that AP, and then anyone who is indirectly in that chain of command. And I think it's the last two pieces where sometimes that might trip up a firm. Branch office. Branch offices must be listed with us. I'll give a few specific details since COVID, this has changed a little bit, but any location other than the main business address that employs one or more persons engaged in activities requiring registration as an AP. That's any location where one or more APs, there are some exclusions, any location where one or more APs from the same household work, so a home office, does not need to be listed. As long as the location is not held out to the public as an office of the member firm, the AP is not meeting with customers in person or handling customer funds, and that any CFTC or NFA required records are maintained at the main office or a listed branch office. Another important thing about the branch offices is that they should be listed on your form 7R. And last thing, bylaw 1101, this is one of the keystone rules of NFA, but you cannot do business with anyone who is not registered with NFA, but is required to be registered with NFA. And our firms typically are good at doing this review over their customers at onboarding, it's also important that you remember to do this annually, especially if they are claiming an exemption, that you are reviewing NFA's basic system on our website to make sure that any exemptions are still valid.
Thanks, John. Tara, how about promotional material?
Thanks, Dawn. Yes. Before I get to that, I saw some people taking pictures in the audience. I just want to let you guys know that the slides will be posted on the website as well, in case you miss anything. So NFA Compliance Rule 2-29 governs the use of promotional material. A lot of times, some common deficiencies that we see regarding promo is an unbalanced presentation. So what do I mean by unbalanced? If your promotional material is talking about profit, alpha, generating alpha all the time, and there's one tiny disclaimer at the end of the material about the risk of loss, that's not okay. So throughout the presentation, it doesn't have to be a one-to-one ratio, but it should be also discussing the risk of loss if you're talking about profits. Also, the presentations should include the proper disclaimers. If you are including performance in your material, past performance is not indicative of future results. And any statements of fact should be supported. So if we do end up testing promotional material on our exams and you have statements of fact in your material, we will ask you for support for those facts. I would stay away from hyperboles like we're the greatest, we're the best. And if you do have any statements of fact, for example, if you're touting an award that you guys have won, we will ask you for support for the award. If you are saying that you are the largest asset manager in the world, we will ask you for your support for that as well. And lastly, I want to cover hypothetical performance and the requirements there. Hypothetical performance, if you're going to use it, needs to be clearly identified and labeled as hypothetical. You must disclose the material assumptions that go into your hypothetical performance, and verbatim, you must have the hypothetical performance disclaimer from our website.
Thank you. Before we move on to the specific registration categories, does anyone have any questions?
Thank you. I have a question about the third-party service providers. So some registered CPOs and CTAs have incredibly long-standing relationships with, say, like administration agents or custodians, and that may go back into the mists of time. And so that can cause a lot of heartburn when they need to somehow demonstrate what the initial risk assessment was. That may go way, way, way past any kind of record-keeping requirement. Can you talk to how or speak to how they should address that when questions come up on an NFA exam? Thank you.
Sure. So the interpretive notice went into effect in 2018 or 2019. I don't know the date offhand, but there is a specific date where if you had a relationship with a third party before that date, then you're exempt from the initial risk assessment and the onboarding due diligence. We would still expect you to be doing the ongoing monitoring though. So if it's been more than 8 years, you're in the clear for that.
And also just make sure if that relationship were to terminate again, that you have proper, that you're following those procedures for that as well.
Any other questions?
Okay. Okay, so Tara, can you tell us about some common CPO and CTA findings?
Yes, absolutely. So some common findings that we do see at CPOs, CTAs regarding disclosure is sometimes we'll see a performance table. And again, we will ask you for support for this performance. We don't always get the support, or sometimes even the support is calculated incorrectly. Rate of returns presented must be net of fees, which is just a reminder to everyone. And then another reminder, CTA proprietary performance. If you are including it, it must be separate from the other performance. Okay, so how many people in the audience either work at a CPO or advise a CPO? I think there's some more because I've been to your firms and I know who you are. Okay, so this slide is for you. So NFA compliance rule 2-50 states that if you have any of the following, you must file notice with the NFA. So one, if your pool cannot meet its margin call, if the pool is unable to satisfy redemption requests in accordance with your PPM or subdocs, if your pool has halted redemptions at all, or if you receive notice from a counterparty that a pool is in default. So this is typically happening when there's like a huge market event. We're not talking about you get a margin call today, and which you're going to meet tomorrow. And I think a lot of times this can kind of get lost at CPOs just because, you're reaching out to all other parts of the business. You're talking to investors. You're trying to communicate to everybody. But this is your reminder to make sure you file with the NFA as well. Some common deficiencies that we see regarding exemptions is firms not maintaining support to demonstrate that you are in compliance with the exemptions. The biggest one I can think of and that we see often is really 413A3 pools. Because there's such a limited reporting requirements, I think a lot of people forget about this. But you must be actively checking and maintaining that the pool constantly is meeting the de minimis exemption. Another one that came about recently are changes to the QEP requirements under CFTC Regulation 4.7. So the portfolio requirements for QEPs have essentially doubled effective March 2025. So it used to be the portfolio requirement was $2 million in securities and or $200,000 on deposit at an FCM or a combination of the two. It is now $4 million in securities or $400,000 on deposit at an FCM or a combination of the two. So just a reminder there, if your participants used to meet the QEP requirements before under the old rules, they cannot add any funds to their account. Or if you're a CTA client, you cannot open another fund until they meet the new requirements. Okay, so CPO financial reporting, account statement requirements. Some things that we see frequently, some deficiencies are on the account statements, the pools. NAV isn't reflected as a whole. That is a requirement. The pool's ending NAV as well as the change in NAV for the pool as a whole needs to be on the account statement, not just the investor interest. Series class information needs to be on the statement. Timely distribution. So statements have to go out within 30 days of month end. And for 4-7 funds, fund of funds, the rule has changed a little bit to give a little bit more leeway to investors who receive monthly account statements. So you have 15 more days for a total of 45 days until after month end if you're sending a monthly statement. Incomplete or missing oath, we do see this also from time to time. Signature, someone who's signing off on the oath and affirmation needs to be able to bind the CPO. Usually this is very high level people, the CEO, the CCO, the CFO, your receptionist can't sign off on your oath and affirmation. The signatory's name must be there and the capacity in which they're signing as well as the CPO's name and the pool.
Thanks, Tara. John, can you tell us common findings for FCMs, FDMs, and IBs?
Great. Yeah, so starting with net capital, the primary issues we see are improperly classifying certain assets as a current asset, thus increasing your net capital or your excess. So starting with secured receivables, those specifically those from affiliates, there are some things to keep in mind for secured receivables, again, specifically from affiliates, but they must be readily marketable, easily converted. The firm must have possession or direct control over the assets. We, as the regulators, we're going to review the records. We need access to the books and records potentially of the affiliate with the transactions. And the firm must have a perfected security agreement in place just to ensure that in the event of a default, so to speak, that the member firm is going to have first rights over those assets. Some other common items: commissions received from FCMs. These are current assets, but it's important to make sure that the firm's records agree with the records or the statements that they're receiving from the clearing FCM. Aging receivables, reclassifying them from a current asset to a non-current asset. If a receivable has aged, a standard is 30 days. If a receivable has aged over 30 days, it's the firm's responsibility to then move that to a non-current asset. One of the common items we'll request on an exam is a listing of aging receivables. So this is a document that the firm should ideally be maintaining. Another item is prepaid assets. These are always non-current, such as insurance premiums, rents. And the last item is restricted balances. These should also be non-current. And some examples might be a security deposit on an office lease or a bank account with withdrawal restrictions. Some other items on net capital. We are on an accrual basis. The firm should be providing its books and records on an accrual basis. One of the important things to keep in mind are legal fees, and not just the day-to-day fees and invoices, but also any potential liabilities that you might have if the firm is involved in litigation and is expecting a adverse decision, and there are potential fines associated with that. And last thing on net capital is to ensure that the firm is taking the proper charges. So haircuts on securities, I would advise you to look at the 1FR guide for on our website, on CFTC's website, that has a lot of useful information on that. And also foreign currency position charges, again, applies to both FCMs and FDMs, but for any of our FDM member firms, this is a critical part of the net capital computation. This is going to include a charge not only on foreign currencies on the firm's balance sheet, but also any unhedged customer risk. Some other things on FCMs and FDMs are our daily reporting requirements. So for a FCM, their daily segregated, secured, or cleared swap statement is due at noon locally. So if you are in New York, it's due at noon New York time, not Chicago time. A FDM also has several daily reports. So they have a daily financial report as well as a daily Fortress reporting. It's a data dump of the firm's activity for the day. Other reporting requirements are notice filings. I would advise anyone who works in this area to review CFTC 1.12, because there are many different areas that notice filings cover, the most prominent of which are changes to a material change to operations, changes in senior management. If the firm were to fall under net capital, that is an important one. They're typically due within 24 hours, sometimes 48 hours. Again, it depends on the type of notice. So again, I urge you to look at 1.12. Some of these are also due immediately or same day, such as if you were to fall under your net capital requirement. And lastly, this is a newer one for us here, but firms that are dealing in cleared swaps, including fully collateralized event contracts, must perform an LSOC calculation. Again, this is a relatively new area for us, but this has been a very common deficiency at our event contract FCMs. The cleared swap statement that the FCMs are reporting to us does contain pretty much 99% of the information you need. You just need to make sure that you are actually doing the LSOC calculation. If you would like more details on that, there is a helpful Jack member alert on the Jack member page. For public disclosures, FCMs and FDMs must provide certain information on their website. This is going to include basic information such as their name, address, contact information, what sort of operations they cover. It also should include any material risks involved with the firm, as well as any recent enforcement actions. There's also certain financial information that is required to be posted regularly to the website. You can find more information on what disclosures are specifically required at CFTC 1.55.
Okay. And just to wrap it up with some common overdue items, which applies to all membership categories, just keep in mind things that need to be done timely, such as your cybersecurity, AML training, branch office audits. All of those need to be done annually. Make sure your ethics training is being done in accordance with your procedures. Especially keep this in mind when you have new hires, because we frequently find that firms maybe forget about their new hires and getting those ethics training done in accordance with those procedures. And just remembering to submit your financial statements timely to NFA. And finally, I just want to highlight again that self-examination questionnaire that needs to be done annually. You need to sign it, date it. But really, I do emphasize spending the time to go through it because it is very helpful. It will help you avoid a lot of common findings. Another thing I want to highlight is that NFA sends out an annual regulatory reminders email to specific registration categories each year. Really take the time to read that, go through that, so that you can help your firm avoid some of these common findings. And this concludes our presentation. Does anyone have any other questions?
Hi. So a couple of slides ago, you mentioned you had a information on branch offices. And I think what it said was like for those requiring to be registered as an AP. And I got this question passed by me the other day. I know many firms are taking advantage, say, of tax breaks, so they might move to both in New York and Chicago to maybe Florida or Texas. And you might move, say, an operations staff to Dallas. And within that staff, you might have members that have a license as an AP that passes Series 3 and whatnot, but they're not acting in a sales capacity. So the question I got passed, passed on to me was like, does that mean we've got registered guys, they're not acting in that capacity, but does that, require branch registration?
Yeah. So the Series 3 itself doesn't trigger any sort of branch office requirement. If the employee just happens to have a Series 3, but they're not performing any functions that would require registration, then no, the office would not be need to be listed. It's actually a good reminder.
If they're registered as an AP, having the Series 3 is one thing. However, if they're registered as an AP, you do have to be careful because they are still registered as an AP. So you have to keep in mind, how are you supervising that office? Is that office being held out in sales capacity? So it gets a little trickier if they're registered as APs.
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood the question. They are registered as an AP? Oh, okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
We have another question here.
Are independent contractors that are not Series 3, not APs, admin operations, are they required to do cybersecurity and ethics training?
So cybersecurity, if they have, I mean, it depends on what their role is. As they're a consultant, they have access to your systems, then yes, they should be taking cybersecurity training.
Hi, I have a Series 3 registered AP conducting block futures activity, travels overseas to affiliate office that does no NFA business at all. Can he operate there or would that have to be a branch? Temporary basis, just on a vacation, but he wants to go into the office 2 days and do some work.
I mean, yeah, I think we could talk to you about that specific scenario afterwards.
When you talk about an annual requirement, is that calendar? Is that 365 days with respect to certain, you know, like cybersecurity, AML training, branch reviews, that kind of thing? Because over the years, I've seen that as a focal point from time to time.
Yeah. So typically, if you've done it, if you signed off on it in 2026, we would expect you to sign off on it again in 2027.
Any other questions? All right. Yeah.
Regarding promotional material, regarding promotional material, do your rules generally fall in line with the SEC's marketing rules?
I mean, typically, I would say that yes. You know, promotional material should be, you know, we're looking for all the same things. We don't want it to be unbalanced. We don't want it to be misleading in any way. So in that regard, in that case, yes, I would say so.
Any final questions before we wrap up? Yes.
Thanks so much. So I saw that the NFA and the SEC had signed or entered into an MOU. Which seemed to suggest there might be coordination of exams. I represent a lot of registered investment advisors who are also co-registered as CPOs or CTAs. Is there any information you can provide to us about that MOU and how that might affect NFA exams?
So usually if we were to be doing that, we are going to share, I think, our list of exams probably with them. If we coordinate with them, that's great. If they have been in right before us, we may talk to them about the exam and what they looked at and any concerns or share any concerns that we have. So we will try.
Well, thank you so much, Dawn, Tara, and John, for a great session on exam prep and common findings.